You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. /7:19 on a Tuesday. Mike McNamara with you. We continue. Joining me is Tom Droughty, retired United States Marine Corps Brigadier General and an infantry officer by trade via the United States Naval Academy. And now, Tom, forgive me, but where are you teaching?
I'm teaching at St. Leo University here in Florida, as well as the University of South Florida in Tampa. So I teach Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at St. Leo, and Monday and Wednesday at USF. And interesting, my class yesterday was on Desert Storm, and my guest was retired Colonel Tony Gain, Marine Corps, who was General Schwarzkopf's operations officer during Desert Storm. So it was an amazing opportunity for the students to hear firsthand the things that were going on with the General Schwarzkopf headquarters as we were launching into Desert Shield and then especially Desert Storm. And I commented that one of the things that I admire most about Tony is that he was the Marine closest to General Schwarzkopf. General Johnson was there as well, but, you know, briefed him every day and so forth. And one of the things that General Schwarzkopf did that always will bring about my respect and admiration was his exhibiting one of the great leadership traits, and that was to leave people alone. He gave the Marines a mission and then left us alone. And although we changed our plan about half a dozen times, he never came back and said, hey, will you make up your mind, you know, be decisive. He just let us do what we thought was necessary, and we had the results that we acquired. But part of that, I think, was Colonel Gain, who, along with me, contrasted Desert Shield, Desert Storm with Vietnam. So it's been a chance to resurrect old memories and feelings, as well as to share with the youngsters some things that they should know, and hopefully it will not make some of the mistakes that we did.
Well, there wasn't too many mistakes. Desert Storm's almost the perfect one. When you look at it, it's hard to find, you know, an opponent who laid down in front of you. In a way that we would prefer, honestly. In the desert is something we can do, and also in a conventional fight, which is something that we do better than anybody on the planet.
You bet.
And then also to have a limited, there was a limited objective. There was a limit of advance, and that defined with the coalition, and then to get that done, and then to be able to turn that over to somebody else, leave a small residual force to backload, and then to leave, almost like the perfect conflict.
Well, in addition, and all of those things were key points that I've shared, Mac, but in addition, the part of the presidential leadership to explain to the American people why we were doing what we were about to do, and to clearly express that, and with that, to have then the support of the American people and overwhelmingly weigh in. Tony pointed out one day they came in early in the stages, and these bags of mail are there from Americans written to any soldier, any sailor, any Marine, enemy. He's one that he still keeps is a little prayer book that was put together by a 5-year-old. You know, it's so moving and so touching when you think of the tremendous support that was provided by the American people, because we explained to them what it was that we were doing and why, and that is so critical. George Marshall said that no democracy can survive a 7-year war, and the point is that the people have to be behind it in order to sustain it, obviously, and there has to be that moral impetus on the part of the nation, and that was certainly the case in Desert Storm.
Tom Droughty, my guest. I want to talk about Syria. I want to get your thoughts on the missile strike. And I had I don't know if you know Ben Connerble. He a former Marine intel guy, prior enlisted machine gunner, currently works for the RAND Corporation. You'll see him in the Washington Post on occasion. And the word that kept coming up in our discussion, in my discussion with he and John Allen came on as well on Friday, was the word strategy. Was the word, whatever we do has to be linked to a broader strategy that gets us to a better place that we're committed to as a nation, based on American values, based on our foreign policy, something that we can sign up for the long term. Yet our problem in Syria in the long term has been the lack of a partner on the ground in Syria that we can partner with. So I'm curious, into that quagmire, nerve gas is dumped. The United States responds by itself. It wasn't a joint airstrike with the Brits, the French, the Germans. It was an American event. So as kind of the dust has settled around that, your thoughts on the strike itself, the situation in Syria, American options, can we go down that road?
Yeah, it's interesting that you should raise this. I reminded class the other day of a saying that tactics without strategy is the noise you hear just before defeat. And so often we get so engaged in the tactics of a situation without the strategy. What is that we're trying to do? What is the end result that we're trying to achieve? And that's the thing I think we have to be careful of in Syria. I think that the strike was the right thing to do. It certainly demonstrated that this administration is going to pay attention to those things and is not going to let go unnoticed or unresponded. Things as egregious as a chemical attack, regardless of who the perpetrator is, and regardless of who the victims are. But then we start to, I think, merge from that or evolve from that into, I saw the Secretary of State the day indicated we rededicate ourselves to holding to account any and all who commit crimes against innocence anywhere in the world.
No.
This now expands that strategy, that mission or that focus considerably, and it reminds me of John F. Kennedy's we'll bear any burden, pay any price in the defense of liberty. Where do our national interests come in all of this, because that's really should be the reasons why we go to war, is to defend, protect our national interests. So I think there's got to be that view, and along with it, as we're attempting to do right now, to wean away Russia from its support of Syria. The visit of the Secretary of State, I think he goes there tonight.
Right.
Be very interesting as he talks to his counterpart. He has met already with Putin when the Secretary of State was with Exxon, so he knows him. And but an opportunity for Russia to really analyze its role vis-a-vis Syria. Remember, in 2013, Russia stepped forward after we had drawn the red line and said, "Oh no, we can resolve this. We'll just get Syria to eliminate all its chemical weapons," and kind of led the charge in that regard to the acclaim of many throughout the world. And
that was the entire pretext of them going, yes?
Yeah, and so that was the U.S. Kind of looking like again the leading from behind of, well, there's not going to be a red line. It's all going to go away because the Russians will lead this effort to eliminate the chemical weapons. But then following that, Russia then becomes more and more engaged with airstrikes and so forth. So I guess there's been a couple of strikes against Russia. One is that they obviously did not eliminate all the chemical weapons, as was the agreement in 2013. But then secondly, it's complicity in the chemical attack. And I've read a bit about this on both sides of the argument, but it's hard to believe that Russia was not aware that a chemical attack was going to take place from that air base where Russians were also stationed, and also the use of drones, which the Syrians don't have, the Russians do. So I think there's a complicity on the part of Russia that they must really have to, must not at this point analyze as to what they want in Syria, and is it worth it? Is it worth it, the possible sanctions, the possible further action? Because President Trump has indicated that all options are on the table, and that to include future attacks, not just of chemical weapons, but also of the barrel bombs with chlorine or just a conventional weapon. So this has the potential, Mac, of expanding tremendously, and very much a player in this is Russia and to a lesser degree Iran, in my opinion.
Putin, you know, appears to be, to me, nothing more than a glorified gangster. I mean, what incentive is there for him to continue to create this east-west divide? You know, economically, Russia needs to wean itself off oil and diversify its economy. How does he do that? He does that by expanding trade, expanding commerce, and so to what extent does he do these things simply to reassert Russian power around the world? Well, he could do that as a partner, you know, with NATO, with the United States, to go solve these issues, and yet he seems to have no interest in this. And now I'm curious, Tom, your thoughts about there is a Iranian, you know, yesterday or Sunday, the Iranians and the Russians both said, you know, hey, we have our own red line. And if the Americans step over that again, there'll be a shooting war. You know, and so that kind of rhetoric was kind of bounced around. And I want to get your assessment of the Russian military capability in the region. And I know that it'll all be based on general source, so it's not, you know, we don't have access to classified information anymore.
Right. So,
but they're, no matter how they advertise their capabilities, they never really stack up very well against ours. So I'm curious, militarily in the region, how does your thoughts on how that stacks up?
I think Russia, and you put your finger on it, wants to regain a degree of influence. And then looking at the options, Syria seemed to be the best one, and along with Iran to provide that support. But it's interesting. I noticed the other day is kind of a small piece, but Russia attempting to get back into Afghanistan and to align itself with, of all people, the Taliban.
Huh.
And once again, that desire to have a greater influence, you know, in the Mideast on the part of Russia. I think Putin, of course, is a product of the Soviet Union. And when that crumbled, I believe that Putin and others yearned for the good old days, at least in their perspective, of when the Soviet Union was truly a force to be reckoned with. And not that Russia is not, but it's certainly not the days of the Soviet Union. So I think it's a desire to flex, to expand, to demonstrate a power and influence, particularly as it faces the economic challenges at home. And throughout history, we've seen where there's domestic difficulties or challenges of any way, shape, or form. One of the best ways to take the people's attention away from that is to focus outward, and that is to the bad guys outside the borders rather than the bad economics inside the borders.
My experience in Afghanistan, when the Russian word was brought up and, you know, when the Soviet Union was brought up, it was met with universal rebuke because of the barbaric way that the Russians treated the Afghan people. The stories that some of the tribal chiefs and the village elders would tell about Hind helicopters, about, you know, artillery as they fought the Taliban were incredible to hear, and how much they hated the Soviet soldiers because they were just barbarians. And, you know, Vladimir Putin wears a suit and he looks very Western, blah, blah, blah. But I will tell you what, and Tom, you can comment on this. The Russians are not a Western European nation. when you see them, they are a brutal, brutal, brutal armed force. They don't care. The Russians were a brutal nation to begin with. And they shoot first, they shoot second, they shoot third, and they don't care where it goes. And if you get killed, then you get killed. So, your thoughts on that? Have you ever operated close to the Russians? Do you have much experience with them?
Only on embassy duty. And these are the days of the evil empire. And of course, we had a detachment in Moscow, and then I put in a detachment in Leningrad. But I think your description is exactly right. I mean, this is very focused, but very human rights oriented organization towards its own, let alone towards enemies or potential enemies. So, I think Putin is, his spots have certainly not changed. He is what he was, a KGB officer of some success, obviously. But this is a force that certainly has demonstrated in history its worth in the destruction of Nazis and in World War II. The Soviet Union was in many ways, thank God for them, because of the brutality that they absorbed of the Nazis, as well as inflicting on them as well. But yeah, there's still that belief on the part of the Russians. I think Sandy and I took a trip there not too many years ago. It was after the fall, and it was amazing in talking with people in the sensing that in many ways they yearn for the old days of not just the Soviet Union, but also almost going back to the Tsar. It was almost like they wanted to get back under the yoke in order to be happy, if you will. An amazing mindset. But anyway, I'm not sure I'm really...
No. I just wondered if your experience was any different from mine. Let me read you an email. Hey, Mac, I'm curious about General Drowdy's thoughts. If we got into a shooting war with the Russians, what would happen in Syria? And so let me give you a hypothetical. More nerve gas is used. The United States responds. The Russians respond by using their air defense system. The United States then takes out Russian air defense systems. We have an aircraft shot down and lose a pilot. They lose a number of people as we take out their air defense systems. Does it escalate beyond that? I know they have a ship in the Med, but beyond that, do you see any further danger of conflict escalation? Tom, so address that scenario, which seems to be not too far out of the case or not too far-fetched if, in fact, the Russians, it's interesting, and I thought of this, I didn't say it, but I thought of this when you were talking about the Russians being complicit. If you've ever been around chemical weapons, when they're moved, when they're stored, or any kind of special weapon, when they come out of their magazines and they're not stored with the other ordnance, it is a big deal, okay? A lot of people need to be notified to stay out of the area because of the issues associated with that type of ordnance. So if you're at that facility, if you're at that airfield, and you see something extremely unique going on, and we think that, oh yeah, well the Syrians are going to move nerve gas, but they're not going to tell their Russian, friends. That didn't happen. Okay?
No.
Just the logistics alone require the Russians as a courtesy to be notified so they don't do anything while the Syrians are moving this ordnance, while they're loading this ordnance, and just so the Russians make sure they steer clear if it wasn't organized by the Russians themselves. So at worst, they knew. And there's no doubt in my mind.
And added to that, the Russian propensity as well as their talent for spying on people, friend, foe, or otherwise. I just find it unbelievable to think that they were not aware of the use, and particularly egregious, besides that complicity, was their the fanfare that went in 2013 with the Russians are going to step in and solve this this problem of Syria, and so red lines will not be necessary. So I just it's interesting, Mac, that in the negotiations or the agreements that are underway with Russia and the U.S. regarding aircraft in Syria,
right,
that after our missile attack, after the Tomahawk missiles, the Russians didn't terminate those. They suspended them. And it's interesting that that choice was made of, this isn't, okay, this is over forever, we're never going to talk to you again. It was simply, or rather, suspended, which would mean the possibility of re-engaging, which I think is going to be mandatory in order to avoid inadvertent shoot-down of aircraft by Russia versus U.S.
Tom Drowdy, my guest. So we have to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to get your thoughts on where the United States goes forward in Syria, and then I want to talk about North Korea real quick, if you don't mind.
Surely.
All right. We're talking current events here on a Tuesday. More of that coming up next on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is wow. I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer, but I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, Call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
This is Montel Williams. As a U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran, I know the sacrifice that our servicemen and women make for us every single day. If you're a veteran or a military member transitioning out of the service, help is available to you. The U.S. Department of Labor can help you get training, find a good job, or further your education. Contact the Veterans Employment and Training Service at 866-487-2365 or visit dol.gov/vets.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Tuesday, we continue. My guest this morning is Tom Droughty, retired Marine Corps Brigadier General, and we're talking Syria right now. So, give me a way ahead in Syria. The United States, I don't know, kind of mixed messages. We'd like to see Assad go. There can be no peace. There can be no peace. That's a different version of, you know, we can live with him from a month ago. Give me your thoughts on the direction the nation ought to take.
First of all, Mac, I think there's got to be a single message from the administration. And just as you pointed out, we've heard some say he's got to go. And let me just go down that path for a second. One of the things that we have a tough time learning is it's easy to create vacuums. It's challenging to fill that vacuum in a productive way. In Vietnam, the Viet Cong never created a leadership vacuum like a hamlet chief, village chief, unless and until they had someone to put in to take the particular place. That was not the prudence on the part of the South Vietnamese and the U.S. So creating vacuums can have results that are certainly unintended. But I think some of the administration is saying Assad has got to go. My question would be, and then what's next? But if the other part is that not everyone in the administration is saying Assad has got to go, it then followed that this would not be unilaterally on the part of the U.S. And then others are saying, well, maybe he can and his family can be moved to some place, et cetera. So there's got to be a uniform position on the part of the U.S. Is it that Assad has got to go, or that there's going to be some kind of negotiation that can eliminate what he has perpetrated on his people? I saw an interesting piece that we might have provided the Russians really a favor with the strikes, and it follows this scenario. The Russians have to be less than happy with Assad at this point and say to him, you've seen what the U.S. can do, not only in what they hit, but what they did not hit, which is a testimony to the accuracy of the Tomahawk missiles and other precision weapons that the U.S. has in great abundance and the technical knowledge to use them. But with that in mind, do you really want to continue along this line, or is it now time for you to consider a different route? And in the process, allow the Russians to kind of ease their way out of this bind that they're now in by backing this war criminal who's received the condemnation of the world. So an interesting way of looking at...
And the Syrian response will be, we have no other road to go down. So we will not, as Syrians, we have nowhere else to go, to quote Zach Mayo from An Officer and a Gentleman. There's no what other road are we going to go down? Because the only other road is for Bashar al-Assad to leave, and we're not doing that.
Leave or at least stop the violence perpetrated on his people to the point of then perhaps a new change of government in Syria that would not continue with the war crimes that he's perpetrating. But I'm thinking from the standpoint of Russia being used as the leverage in this regard of, yeah, they've responded along with Iran that they're going to hold us accountable in the future, and that's kind of an expected response. But I think in many ways we've given Russia an opportunity to ease its way out of the bind in which it has placed itself.
So when the Russians present that to the Syrians, knowing the Syrians don't have another card to play and that Assad is not going to step down. I mean, if he does, that would be great, but I think the assumption is he's not. And so when he responds to the Russians, sorry, that is not in the cards, the Russians then can use that as a pretext to unass Syria.
Well, that or the other option would be say, all right, our support of you is finished because we can no longer be a part of this war crime that you're committing. And with that goes the Russian support. Iran, don't know how they would react to all of this, but I think with the departure of Russia or the lessening of Russia's support, that Iran would be not as vigorous as they have been in the past. My only point in all of this is that the ones that we can talk to with some degree of I think, communication clarity is Russia. And by pointing out, as I'm sure Secretary Tillerson will, the disadvantage for Russia to continue on supporting the Assad regime will provide then to Russia some options to consider vis-a-vis Syria and in the long run vis-a-vis Iran.
You know, it just seems so stupid because, you know, we can create a peaceful and orderly, we can create a more peaceful and more orderly world in which the Russian economy can thrive in. Why Putin continues to want to be a confrontational leader is beyond me. It just seems like he has this picture of himself as this kind of gangster thug taking Russia back to some kind of evil empire greatness. I don't know. It just seems absurd to me in terms of the potential that the Russians have to be a partner and to create a world in which their economy can thrive. I don't see the long-term strategic good for the Russian people. Email question. Hey, Mac, I'm curious. General Droughty's opinion of a question you talked about yesterday. Should the United States be afraid of the Russians militarily? Sir?
No. I don't think there's any if ands, or buts about that. We have the best military in the world, and there's no one that we should fear. We certainly have to be concerned about Russia as well as China, certainly the terrorism that takes place. But from a standpoint of military prowess, in a conventional fashion, there's no one that can stand up to the United States. So, and I think all the countries of the world understand that and recognize that. Therefore, the reason that any attempts against us are going to be in an unconventional way, such as the cyber attacks, terrorism, et cetera, but no one is going to take us on conventionally. And again, the last time that happened was Desert Storm, and we saw the results of that.
Tom Droughty, my guest, retired Marine Brigadier General, joining us on a Tuesday talking current events and in the news today and over the course of the weekend. Obviously, things that I think are very disturbing. Confrontation with with Russia and with Iran. Next email deals with Iran. Hey, Mac, I saw the headlines over the weekend. I thought it was very sobering, the threat of Russia and Iran. I listened to you yesterday, You said the United States would make short work with Iran. General Droughty's thoughts on that. I said that we would blow Iran away in a matter of minutes. That if they chose to go down that road militarily, that they would suffer the same fate as the Iraqis did. Your thoughts on that, sir?
Yeah, similarly, again, I keep, and I guess I'm really in the minority here, I keep having hopes for Iran. Their leadership certainly hates the United States, and we understand all of that, but in talking to a number of people, some foreign service folks, the people who've lived in Iran, have been there recently and so forth, I think there's still hope that that the people will realize that there's more to be gained by a positive relationship with the United States than a negative one. So, but from a military, to answer your question, from a military standpoint, yes, I firmly believe that we Iran would suffer severely in a fight with us, and of course, no sane leadership wants to risk that. But having said sane leadership, kind of causes me to jump to think about North Korea, where there's an absence of that sane leadership, and the real threat that North Korea poses with a truly madman who cares nothing about his people. So that, I think, in so many ways, is probably the greatest threat that we're facing at this point.
My own opinion is we need to throw up and in on both the Russians and the Iranians, and they need to get their pants pulled down in public. And if it takes some military action, but the United States needs to assert itself on the world stage, because the last thing the world needs is the Russians running amok, along with the Iranians, and some kind of pan-Iranian old Ottoman empire that would stretch from, you know, Iran proper through Iraq and into all of Syria. The world doesn't need that. And I think dealing with ISIS right now gives us the opportunity to have a greater presence there and to be honest, to be blunt, to block the spread of Iranian influence into that part of the world, which is not good for us. It's certainly not good for Israel. And if it takes some kind of military confrontation, then I think that it's in the long-term best interest of Western Europe and the Middle East that the Russians are ejected from there and put in their place. And the same thing for the Iranian. You're not that tough of a guy. So don't play that on the world stage or we'll smoke you, because we are that tough of a guy. So let me switch gears and we'll talk about North Korea. I agree with you. The truly scary one is North Korea. And I want to get your thoughts. Most of the time, a carrier battle group operating off the Korean Peninsula happens with, as a matter of course, supporting whether it be old operations like Team Spirit and things like that. When we had major exercises going on, that would not have aroused raised an eyebrow. It does now, with the test of the intercontinental ballistic missiles, the upcoming and the past test of underground nuclear warhead test. At what point does an American administration take him seriously and begin to ratchet up the stakes to resolve this in some kind of way? Your thoughts on that, sir?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the big signal is a carrier battle group that instead of heading to Australia for R&R, is instead heading for the waters off Korea. So, no one can view that with anything other than concern and a commitment and a resolve on the part of the U.S. that we consider what's going on in North Korea dangerous. Not just for us, but for the entire free world. But once again, just my being an optimist helps in this regard.
How can you be an optimist with that guy? What is the rational basis for your optimism?
Well, the leverage of China.
But they've never used it, or if they have used it, it's never been successful. So again, well, I ask you, sir, what is the rational basis of your knowing that hope's not a course of action?
No.
What is the rational basis of your optimism?
That in the dinner of the head of China Xi with President Trump, and the announcement that we had launched the missiles in Syria, the response was seemed to be, interesting. It was not, I'm leaving this dinner. I'm leaving the United States. This is outrageous that you do such a thing. That kind of response from a nation like China, to me, along with the indications that I'm just reading here, China's taken modest steps to increase the pressure. It agreed with South Korea on Monday to impose tougher sanctions on North Korea if it carries out nuclear intercontinental ballistic missile tests, a senior South Korean diplomat said. So China is still in the game and is the major factor of any degree of control that might work for North Korea. And the fact that China is not does not seem to be at odds with us on this, I think, is encouraging. So I think there's action certainly short of direct military action, unless it is called for against North Korea. But I still think China is a nation through which we must work in order to come to some kind of a resolution or an agreed position vis-a-vis North Korea, so it's not seen as a South Korea-U.S. Ganging up on North Korea, but other nations in the vicinity, of course, China, Japan, a great interest in North Korea's regaining of sanity, or at least keeping under wraps the insanity that exists there now.
Okay. I agree that China certainly has to be considered, and I would imagine that they had discussions about exactly that. How will China play a role in this? There was just, I guess, a meeting between the Chinese and the South Koreans that went on yesterday. I saw the story about that today, saying that they had agreed on a way forward. And then North Korea has warned the United States against any further naval moves in the region that it could escalate into war. As a nation that watches intercontinental ballistic missiles, are certainly South Korea within range, Japan within range, Taiwan within range, China within range, certainly Hawaii, Alaska within range, and the northwestern part of the United States within range. At what point does a prudent administration take it seriously? After the launch of the first weapon? Is that what we're reduced to? Because it seems like that's, at some point you have to deal with this guy, and I agree with it that you go with you go with a coalition in the region, but at some point he's got to be called out too, and he's got to be brought to the fence post.
Yeah, and I think there's other ways that they can be pursued. For example, his continued testing of missiles is in violation of a UN Security Council resolution. You might say, well, so what?
Yeah, so what?
In the past, UN resolutions have led to our response to Korea in 1950 and our response against Iraq in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. So getting the UN involved, and I know there's lots of folks, and for good reason, to condemn the UN, but we now have in the UN an ambassador that I've got a lot of confidence in, Nikki Haley, and the things that the country can bring to bear to get UN support for further sanctions against North Korea for its violation of the UN Security Council resolution on the testing of those weapons. Not to be dismissed is the presence of a carrier battle group, within literally striking distance should insanity reign and any effort be made on the part of North Korea. But beyond that, again, with China and South Korea engaged and trying to bring some pressure to bear against North Korea, and again, trying to get the UN involved in this would be the measures that I think have to be pursued, but always ready, as we are, with the ability and the willingness to respond militarily.
Interesting. All right, sir. First of all, I appreciate your time this morning, and as always, enjoyed the conversation. But I don't want to overstate and say dark days we live in, but if they're certainly gray in terms of the consequences and the people that we're dealing with. So thank you very much for joining the discussion again this morning, and wish you all the best and have a great week.
Okay, Mac. You too. God bless you and Semper Fidelis.
Semper Fidelis. That is Brigadier General Tom Droughty, United States Marine Corps, on a Tuesday on the All Warrior Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Grant Newsham's going to join us. He, a retired colonel, United States Marine Corps. He has spent much of his life in Japan. And so we're going to talk to him about the North Korea, Japan, China triangle in this whole issue. So we'll take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on a Tuesday edition on the All Warrior Radio Network.